It concerns the water court rules. The appellant is Cotton Creek Circles and the Ateli Rio Grande Water Conservancy District and others. We're ready to hear from the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Peter Krumholz of the law firm of Hale Friesen LLP, and I represent appellants Cotton Creek Circles and Colorado Association of Home Builders. My partner, Alan Hale, joins me at council table. I'll be presenting argument on behalf of all the appellants in this case, including San Luis Valley Water Company. The legal question before this court is whether costs are awardable against citizens who participate in the state engineer's adoption of water rules. As this court observed in Simpson versus Bijou Irrigation, sections 3792.5013 and 3792.304 are the means chosen by the General Assembly to safeguard against the unreasonable exercise of administrative discretion by the state engineer. Appellants do not ask this court to make policy, but rather to follow the policy choice that the General Assembly has already made. Affirming the award of costs in this case would be inconsistent with that policy choice because it would chill participation in water rulemaking and diminish the effectiveness of the safeguards erected by the General Assembly. Appellees argue that the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure generally apply to water court practice and procedure, and that therefore Rule 54D applies in this case. However, this court suggested otherwise in the Fort Morgan decision. In the Fort Morgan decision, this court indicated that Rule 81A states that the rules do not govern in any special statutory proceeding insofar as the rules are inconsistent or in conflict with the purpose of the statutes. Now, this court recognized in Fort Morgan that water court matters are special statutory proceedings within the meaning of Rule 81A. And although the Fort Morgan decision determined that awarding costs in the context of water rights applications was not inconsistent with the statutes, an award of costs would be inconsistent with the statutes in this case.
Let me ask you this. If you had prevailed, might you be seeking costs or not? And if you would be seeking costs, would the state engineer's office have to pay them, the state of Colorado have to pay them?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that. I think the answer is yes. I don't know whether the state engineer would have to pay because I don't know whether there would have been a waiver of its immunity for that.
If I recall, the state agencies or public agencies may not have to pay costs, but I'm not absolutely certain on that. I think that's my recollection.
I'm not either, Your Honor. There is a case, Colorado Central, from this court, cited in the briefs, in which costs were sought against public agencies, and the court held that those costs were not awardable because immunity was not waived. I don't know. I haven't analyzed whether that holding would apply here. I think it might.
And suppose you had prevailed and the rules were declared that they had to be returned, they couldn't be approved, or they were disapproved in part. Would you be entitled to costs, and if so, under what theory, what legal principle?
Well, I think the answer is we'd be pursuing costs under Rule 54D, Your Honor. We'd be on the other side of this argument.
Yeah, but would you be entitled to them?
I don't believe so because of the immunity issue. But again, I haven't analyzed that. And the only case.
Okay, but let's assume now the other parties. I'm sorry, I didn't refine my question enough. Against the other parties. Now, you know, the same kind of question about subdivisions of the state or local political entities. But let's just say some other private parties came in and took the opposite position from you and you asked for costs. Would you be entitled to them or not under
against
your
the
theory?
Objectors and support?
What's that?
You mean, would we be entitled to costs against the private objectors and
correct,
support?
Correct.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the statutes don't provide for objectors and support under this proceeding. we'd be subject to the same argument that I'm going to make here, which is the statute doesn't contemplate the involvement of objectors and support in this kind of proceeding under Section 5013.
Okay, so, well, go ahead. Let's hear what the nature of this kind of proceeding really is, in your view.
Thank you, Your Honor. The award of costs would be inconsistent with the statutory design for three reasons. The number one reason, Your Honor, is that this was a quasi-legislative proceeding. It was a rulemaking proceeding, not an adjudication between private parties regarding private rights. Unlike the Fort Morgan decision, which did involve a dispute over private water rights. Proceedings under 5013 involve the adoption of uniform prospective rules of general applicability. What distinguishes legislation from adjudication is that adjudication affects individual rights only in the abstract and must be applied in a further proceeding before any particular party's rights are definitively touched by that legislation. And that is precisely the case in this proceeding. None of the appellant's water rights were determined as a result of this proceeding. And they will not be determined until the appellants file their own water rights applications, and the rules which have been confirmed now are then applied to those applications. By contrast, this court has held that quasi-judicial action involves the determination of rights of specific individuals on the basis of presently existing legal standards to past or present facts. A proceeding regarding the state engineer's proposed rules is not directed at the resolution of a dispute concerning any party's private rights. The notion of winners and losers that is inherent in the concept of prevailing parties under Rule 54D is antithetical to a proceeding that is not directed at the resolution of any party's specific rights. The significance of this case was not that the rules were adopted. It is that they were adopted only after the concerns and arguments of the appellants were presented and thoroughly considered.
Well, but the court ended up making a whole series of findings of fact, conclusions of law, and a judgment. It sure looks like it's litigation. You agree or not?
I agree, Your Honor. It was a six-week trial. There were numerous experts on both sides. But that's all by statutory design, Your Honor. 5013 does not provide for any participation by any party prior to filing protests in the water court. It was a proceeding requiring numerous experts before a water court by statutory design, but it was still in the context of a rulemaking.
But counsel, isn't there somewhat of a contradiction there? I mean, on the one hand, you're saying that the legislature contemplated this, you know, rulemaking and this participation in order to review and check authority. And on the other hand, you're confronted with, first of all, the trial court findings, which are very specific about the nature of the litigation and the fact that it was handled like a trial with evidence and objections and so forth. And now you're also admitting that that's consistent. You were not opposed to that type of proceeding. That's consistent as well with statutory design. So isn't there quite a tension there between a statutory design that you claim is rulemaking and at the same time that is also clearly an adjudicatory proceeding an adversarial proceeding such as this?
There undoubtedly is tension here, Your Honor, but the overriding consideration must be that this was the means chosen by the General Assembly to protect against the unreasonable exercise of the state engineer's administrative discretion.
But why doesn't that at least allow for some ambiguity regarding what the General Assembly intended with respect to, you know, how to strike that balance between treating it as litigation with respect to costs or instead treating it as a, you know, some quasi rulemaking proceeding that is not litigation?
I think there's ambiguity only in the sense that only in an implicit sense, Your Honor. If you look at the statutes, there is no ambiguity. The statutes do not provide for the involvement of any objectors in support. The statute does not say anything about an award of costs. Section 5013, which permits the filing of protests to proposed rules, says nothing about an award of cost. Section 304, which 5013 incorporates, specifically does provide for an award of costs, but only in proceedings involving a change in the place of use of a water right from a mutual agricultural ditch or ditch system or reservoir company. Otherwise, Section 304 says nothing about an award of costs in any other circumstance. And if costs are awardable to all Water Corps proceedings by virtue of Rule 54D, then presumably the General Assembly would not have deemed it necessary to provide specifically for costs with respect to one particular circumstance. The fact that the General Assembly specifically provided for costs in only one particular circumstance suggests that they are not awardable in any other circumstance.
What is a procedure for a party to become an objector? What did your client have to go through to become an objector in this case?
Under 5013, the objectors, I call them protesters, Your Honor, just for clarity's sake.
Sure.
But the protesters under 5013 file a protest with the Water Corps.
And is there any requirement as to who can do the protest or what kind of interest the party must have in order to do
Your Honor,
the protest?
The Rule 5013 is very broad, and it's designed to be broadly inclusive. The only limitation is that any person who desires to participate and who wishes to file a protest may do so. So 5013 is limited to any person who wishes to file a protest. It says nothing about objectors in support. It only contemplates that those who wish to protest may do so by filing a protest. I would also note that the rules themselves parrot the language of 5013. The last paragraph of the rules stated, it is further ordered that any person who wishes to protest these proposed rules may do so by filing a protest in writing with the Division III water clerk in Alamosa, Colorado, in the same manner as the protest of a ruling of the referee. So neither the statute nor the rules contemplated objectors in support. It only contemplated protests being filed.
So under your reading of the statute, anyone could file a protest. There's no concept of standing or anything like that.
Our client, the Colorado Association of Home Builders, Your Honor, had no vested interests, no water interests at stake in the San Luis Valley. But the Colorado Association of Home Builders thought that the rules were unfair in the sense that they insulated the water in the San Luis Valley from any use by anyone outside of the valley, and thought that was unfair and wanted the opportunity to participate and did so. And so that's an instance in this case where you have a protester who has no vested interests in the rules other than wanting to be heard as a citizen of the state.
But in all fairness, I know you're quite well aware of this, that the analogous, when you have a contested application and a ruling by the referee, this in support of has sort of become a standard practice in lieu of making a formal intervention request, right? I mean, in all fairness, there, to make the parallel complete, it's the same kind of in support of or in objection to, right? I mean, functionally, that's the practice, isn't it?
Functionally, that may be the practice, Your Honor, but it may be implicit. It may be a matter of water court tradition. But if the Colorado Association of Home Builders comes in to participate in the adoption of the state engineer's rules and knows only what the rules say and what the statute says, they will not be put on notice that they may be subject to a crippling award of costs if they participate.
Okay, fair enough. But as far as standing goes, this ability, Shirola and all its progeny, ability and water proceedings, broadly put, people can be held to their burden of proof. And here, apparently, the state engineer has some kind of burden. I'd appreciate it if you'd describe to me what that is. What does the state engineer have to show that the rules he has adopted are worthy of being ratified in a de novo proceeding or approved by the water court?
Your Honor, if you would excuse me, I'm going to get a drink of water. I apologize. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry. In answer to your question, as I read this court's decision in the underlying case at 183 P3rd 252, that decision was issued March of 2008. What the state engineer had to show was that there was a rational basis for the requirements of the rules. And if you read this court's holding in that case, that was the standard applied, that the state engineer had to show that there was a rational basis for the requirements regarding, for example, vegetation and so forth. And so it seems to me that the standard is only to show that there was a rational basis.
Thank you.
There's another way in which an award of costs would be inconsistent with the statutory design, and it's suggested by this court's analysis in Fort Morgan. The Fort Morgan analysis is premised on the following statement at page 539 of the decision. Water court proceedings are unique in a number of ways, one of which involves the use of the referee. Now, from this premise, the court described water court proceedings as bifurcated, so that during the first phase, before the referee, there is an opportunity to become apprised of the facts, to review the summary of consultation filed by the state engineer, and to explore resolution. Thus, this court noted that by the time the case arrives at the second phase before the water court, the issues have been crystallized for trial. And it was only during the second phase that the Fort Morgan court held that costs are awardable. Now, in this case, the premise on which that analysis was based is not present. Unlike the parties in Fort Morgan, here, by statutory design, there is no opportunity to participate prior to filing a protest in water court. Nothing had been crystallized or sharpened or refined at the time that the appellants filed their protest. Thus, the statute read in light of the Fort Morgan holding indicates that in the unique statutory circumstances of this case, where there is no first phase opportunity to crystallize the issues before a referee, citizens should not have to bear the risk of costs in order to participate. Now, even if court costs are awardable, even if this court determines that costs are awardable, objectors in support are not entitled to costs. They are not prevailing parties. The water court held that determining whether the objectors in support were prevailing parties, quote, requires a close look at the issues in the case and the level and degree of participation. This is not the test for prevailing parties. A prevailing party is one who has succeeded on a significant issue and has achieved some of the benefits sought by the lawsuit. The objectors in support obtained no benefits personal to them because this was not an adjudication of anyone's rights. Nor did the objectors in support obtain any benefits that were distinct from whatever benefits the state engineer derived by this lawsuit. As the water court stated, benefits obtained include the state engineer having rules to manage withdrawals from the confined aquifer. Those are not benefits accruing to the objectors in support, and they do not qualify the objectors in support as prevailing parties. Now, the appellees contend that they had every right to participate as interveners. The first point in response to that would be that they did not file formal Rule 24 motions to intervene. But more importantly, although Section 304 mentions motions to intervene, the language of the statute makes clear that such motions are contemplated only in water right applications. The statute says that intervention is appropriate upon a showing of mistake, inadvertence, or excusable neglect, or to support a referee's ruling. neither instance is applicable in challenges to proposed rules. And it would be unfair to award costs in favor of the objectors in support here where the statutes do not clearly contemplate their participation. Furthermore, allowing...
It seems to me a little bit inconsistent with your idea that the public in general, the public's interest in the optimization of the water resource should be freely invited in. I mean, that it says any person to contribute whatever they have to say in support or objection, whatever evidence, argument they might have.
I disagree, Your Honor.
Okay.
It does say any person.
Well, you describe this as quasi-legislative.
Yes.
I'm just trying to make the analogy that if you're really arguing that point, wouldn't it be fair to say that it's a public process? I mean, we allow people in APA rulemaking, for instance, let's just assume for special reasons under the 69 Act, due to the expertise of the water court and the water judge, that the General Assembly wanted that proceeding in the water court, not in the Denver District Court. But let's follow your analogy that it really is in the nature of quasi-legislative, there ought to be the broadest public standing.
Agreed.
Right?
I understand your point, Your Honor. And the only response I would have is that this is an alternative argument. The objectors in support, if this court determines that costs are awardable, that is, if this court disagrees with my first argument that this was a quasi-legislative proceeding involving a rulemaking and not a contested civil action like the one we had in Fort Morgan, if this court disagrees with that, then we go to the next argument, which is only the state engineer is entitled to costs, not the objectors in support. I agree with you, Your Honor. I understand your point, and I do agree they're inconsistent. And the only answer I have is this is an alternative argument.
Fine. Well, then would you proceed with the state engineer? Because I think that's a pretty interesting question, since the General Assembly has always chosen to fund the public cost of the administrative system and the state engineer's function. So, and let's assume that the state engineer doesn't have to pay costs if the state engineer loses. How would your argument then proceed about the General Assembly's intent with regard to the nature of this proceeding and the possible unilateral recovery of costs by the state that in fact have been advanced out of the taxpayers' money as part of the administrative enforcement system of the state's water resource?
The only answer I have to that, Your Honor, is that there's nothing in the statute indicating that that was the General Assembly's intent. There is nothing in 5013 or in 304 which indicates that that was the General Assembly's intent to have the state engineer's efforts funded by a losing side, if you will.
And nothing contrary to that either. I mean, it's a function of our rulemaking authority and whether we apply our rules or not and whether the trial court has discretion, right?
Well, it may well be that what Your Honor is saying is that this right to an award of costs is implicit. But again, I would go back to the purpose of the statute as recognized by this court in Simpson versus Bijou Irrigation, which is the purpose of 5013 and its incorporation of 304 in this circumstance is to provide a check against the potential abuse of discretion by the state engineer. And our position would be that overriding policy and purpose as expressed by the General Assembly trumps other considerations.
Let me ask you a question if you're finished with that topic. I always thought about this a little bit when I was thinking about it as similar to the PUC cases, which I used to handle as a Denver District Court judge on appeal, and there would be a rulemaking process, and then if there was an objection, it would go to district court for basically a trial, much like what you suggested happened here. So what I want to focus on with you is what happened before the rules were presented to the water judge. And essentially at that point, it's my perception that there was a rulemaking, the procedure, public input, everything that went into those particular rules, creating a body of rules, which were then presented to the district court or to the water judge.
No.
At which point there were objections.
No, Your Honor. The appellants in this case had no opportunity to participate in the promulgation of the rules prior to their being filed with the water court. That's critically important.
All right. Explain then how those rules came to be.
Well, as I understand it, the state engineer put together a decision support system called the RGDSS.
Mm-hmm.
Together, in an informal way, with at least some of the objectors in support in this case, sort of behind the scenes. But I don't...
So there was public input at that point?
No, only with respect to the objectors in support.
Well,
not with respect to anyone else, Your Honor.
Is there any record support of that, what you're saying right now?
Yeah, well, there is.
Are you suggesting that there's something nefarious going on?
Well, I don't know if I would call it nefarious.
What would you call it?
I would call it unfair.
Okay, tell me why, please.
That you have objectors in support, only the vested interests in the San Luis Valley, only certain vested interests.
Well, what are you saying exactly? I'm not understanding this. So what happens? The state engineer wants to come up with these rules, and how does that happen?
You're saying
that certain people who are interested are have some input at that point, but nobody else?
I am saying exactly that, Your Honor. If you look at the underlying order in this case, the water court's 192-page decision, and if you look at the background...
I've looked at it.
Sorry?
I've seen that order. Yeah.
It's hard to miss.
Probably more than you would enjoy.
If you look at the water court's description of the background leading to the rules, it describes the participation of the objectors in support. But there was no formal mechanism
for it. But it doesn't preclude others. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get a grip on is how these rules come to be developed in the first place. And if you could just tell me your understanding of that, I'd appreciate it.
Your Honor, all I can tell you is my understanding that there is no formal mechanism by which anyone may participate in the development of those rules. Colorado Association of Home Builders had, and this is a matter of this court's precedent. The Simpson versus Bijou irrigation case stands for the proposition that citizens have no other opportunity to participate other than filing a protest in water court under Section 5013. That is in part what Simpson versus Bijou irrigation stands for. And so, Your Honor, I don't know how the rules were developed. I don't know the specifics of how the rules were developed. All I know is that my clients and the San Luis Valley Water Company had no opportunity to participate prior to the filing of the rules in the water court. Their first chance was filing a protest in water court. That was it. I see I have only a couple of minutes remaining, Your Honor. Unless there are other questions, I'd like to reserve the last few minutes for rebuttal. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Peter Ampey, representing the state engineer. With me at council table is Mr. David Robbins, representing the Rio Grande Water Conservation District. Also in the courtroom today are Ms. Ingrid Barrier and Mr. Dennis Montgomery, also representing the district. Mr. Bill Paddock and Ms. Beth Ann Parsons, representing the Rio Grande Water Users Association. Mr. Richard Marin, representing the Canales Water Conservancy District. Mr. Robbins and I plan to divide our time equally. This morning, I plan on addressing the propriety of the award of costs after trial on a 3792-501 rulemaking, the Water Court's proper exercise of its discretion. Mr. Robbins will address the propriety of the award of costs to supporters of the rules other than the state engineer and the adequacy of the underlying evidence supporting the Water Court's ruling. Excuse me. But I'd like to begin first by, if I could, address Justice Rice's question about the development of the rules. As of course you're aware, the rules began when the legislature directed the state engineer to begin the Rio Grande decision support.
Could you speak up a little bit? Maybe if you move the podium up a little bit more, sir. Thank you.
As you're aware, is this better?
Yes, it's
thank
for
you.
Me. Thanks.
This began when the legislature directed the state engineer to begin the Rio Grande decision support system process. That idea there was to gather necessary facts to begin the rulemaking to govern groundwater and other uses within the valley. This process went on for some time, was a public process, results.
What does that mean? Opposing counsel seems to suggest that it was only sort of public.
Well, Your Honor, it was certainly not secret. It was not public in the manner of a formal public process under the APA. This was essentially an engineering and scientific process of gathering data, working through data, developing the Rio Grande Decision Support System groundwater model, all of which forms the basis for the underlying rules in this case. As part of that, they held public meetings that anyone could attend. There was a peer review process.
Again, was there notice of the public meetings?
I don't know.
In an APA kind of way or not?
Not in an APA kind of way, Your Honor.
Okay.
It was probably advertised through possibly the paper, but I don't know for sure. Through some of the water user groups, certainly would have known about it. And as this went on, the state engineer developed these rules with help from some of the major water users and also invited a number of other, I guess you call them, the sort of the water bar of the San Luis Valley, at least extended the invitation to come in, give us your comments on the rules. And that was done informally, not as a formal APA process in any way, shape, or form, because under the way this statute is written, it's very different from the APA.
Right.
The legislature essentially gave the discretion to the state engineer to create those rules and then take them to water court. And so that's the process he followed.
Well, wouldn't it be fair to say, too, that the Rio Grande Water Conservation District, a public entity, had numerous public meetings before their board and discussed this and had input?
And probably other boards as well, Your Honor. Yes. So I guess I just want to make clear it was not an APA public process, but it was certainly a public process out there in the open to participants who are interested.
Well, what about, you know, to the petitioner? I mean, how would they have gotten notice? Could they have come in and said something at this stage?
If they had been aware and wanted to, yes, they could.
Mr. Ampey, I just have one question I'd like to clarify here. Are you describing the process that in fact occurred, or the process that was required? And is there any process, if it's the former that was, you're just telling us what happened, was there any particular process that was required?
That is the process that happened. My reading of 501 does not require any public process. To give you an example, the state engineer likes to have public process. You may be aware now there's some other rulemaking going on where he's convened an informal group to assist with those rules. But those are not required by 501, but nevertheless, the state engineer feels public input is a very good thing, and as with these rules, does so. Now, the first question for the court today, then, is whether the water court may award costs at the conclusion of a contested trial to hear and dispose of protests to proposed rules and regulations promulgated by the state engineer under the water rule power, which is 3792501. Now, contrary to Cotton Creek's assertions, Rule 54, as interpreted by this court in Fort Morgan, makes clear that it is within the water court's discretion to award costs. Rule 54D provides that, except when express provision therefore is made, either in statutes or in these rules, costs shall be allowed, as of course, to the prevailing party unless the court otherwise directs. No statute or rule specifically prohibits this award. Now, of course, it's Fort Morgan that provides the framework for applying 54D to the water court proceeding. Fort Morgan makes a clear distinction in the water court between proceedings in front of the referee and the water court. Fort Morgan holds that at the point at which a water court ceases to be a dispute handled informally by a water referee and becomes litigation involving pretrial discovery, sworn live testimony, expert witnesses, it rests within the sound discretion of the trial court to determine whether at the trial's conclusion there is a prevailing party entitled to costs.
What makes it difficult, though, of course, is in Fort Morgan there really were two parties fighting over something real. And here, I mean, it's a lot more abstract. It's a closer to a APA kind of a situation.
It is closer, and had the General Assembly wanted the APA proceedings to apply here, it would have done so. But instead, what it did was have the state engineer go directly to water court and bypass the water referee process. Now, it's important.
Now, the water court is supposed to, ratify, or what is it they do to the rules exactly?
They decree the rules.
Decree, right.
Under this court's ruling in Simpson v. Bijou, The water court must promulgate the rules, file them with the water court. However, they don't go into effect until the water court actually decrees them, whether there are any objections or not. So that's very different from the APA process, where rules are promulgated, they're in effect while challenges are being heard. For this case, the General Assembly decided to go to water court and have a slightly different process with slightly different results and slightly different consequences.
But the effect is the water court has a review and approval and or disapproval power.
Absolutely. Whether or not anyone objects or not, the water court must do that.
And the key point is that they do not go into effect generically to govern the state engineer's administration of the affected water resource until that process is completed. But then, having described as that, you'd have to agree that it's sui generis. I mean, you know, the litigation rule that you cited, you know, we're talking about very specific statutory provision in here, which looks very unlike any kind of contested case where the general reference to, unless, you know, there's a conflict or otherwise, that the water court rules are supplemented by the civil rules of procedure. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, that's true, Your Honor. However, this court looked in Fort Morgan for the indicia of civil litigation and cited such things as pretrial discovery, whether witnesses are presented, cross-examination. And here the water court found, as a finding of fact, that indicia of litigation. The water court found that Cotton Creek and the others participated in pretrial discovery, filed numerous motions, arguments, participated in a 26-day trial, cross-examined witnesses, and affirmatively presented their own evidence to support their case. Those facts support the factual finding of the water court of an indicia of civil litigation, subject then to Rule 54. And although counsel is correct that in this case, we don't go first before the referee. In water court, there's no guarantee that you remain before the water referee. In other words, a case is immediately assigned to a water referee. However, at any time, any party can simply file essentially notice stating that they will appeal to the water court any adverse ruling of the water referee, at which point the water referee re-refers the case back to the water court. And then we are back clearly under that second phase under Fort Morgan. So although there may be a right to appear in water court, there is no necessary right to remain in front of the referee.
I guess one of the problems I'm having is just kind of this slippery slope problem. I mean, this looks and feels and smells like a trial, what we have in front of us. But it's possible that in a different kind of situation, someone could just come in and say, you know, I object, I really think such and such ought to be tweaked. Then wouldn't it be fair in that situation, would it, for there to be a cost?
Absolutely, right.
So given, excuse me, I'm sorry,
no,
do you want to answer?
Yes.
Thank you. Given that those sort of two opposing extremes, that's the slope I'm describing. How do we make sense of that?
Well, Your Honor, to be clear, no one here is arguing that in every single 501 rulemaking rulemaking trial costs are appropriate. To give you an example here, Cotton Creek were not the only objectors. We also had the Bureau of Land Management and the Costilla County Water Conservancy District filed statements of opposition. They remained parties throughout the entire pendency in front of the district, in front of the water court. However, what they did not do, they were there to, I think, as you sort of said, they had some concerns perhaps. They wanted to be part of the process. They wanted to monitor the process. But they did not engage in that indicia of civil litigation. They didn't file discovery requests. They didn't cross-examine the witnesses. They didn't present their own evidence. Now, hypothetically, had we requested costs against those two parties, and even more hypothetically, had the court awarded those, perhaps that's an abuse of discretion. And so to describe your slippery slope, I think that's present, as this court has noted, every time when awarding costs, how do you determine who's the prevailing party? What costs are reasonable? It's always a slippery slope, but that's why we give the discretion to the water court. And so rather than arguing bright-line rule, we're simply saying that the facts as found by the water court in this particular case show that he did not abuse his discretion, did not act arbitrarily or capriciously, and his decision is supported by the record itself.
Mr. Emby, can I, before you move on to that, it seems like what you just said was, this particular party fought the hardest, therefore they get costs. The other people who didn't participate, for many perhaps good reasons, they're government entities or not private entities, they do get costs. I mean, it does it boil down to that? If you fight the hardest, you get costs?
Not at all, Your Honor. Also keep in mind that the water court simply did not grant us all the costs we request. The water court took into account that he would have required a de novo hearing of some sort, of some length, and he also specifically mentioned these sort of public policy implications of allowing people to come in. He realized it was within his discretion to consider those facts, and so reduced the requested cost by one-third. However, the district court also kept in mind that it was these opposers who made this trial go longer than it otherwise would have had to go, and these opposers who lost on every single issue that they raised. And this provides the appropriate support for the discretion of the water court to award costs where appropriate.
Just a follow-up question. I mean, I think you're hearing questions from us that this is an interesting sort of hybrid sort of procedure. And I'm wondering, I guess Concrete argues that we should look at the form or what essentially is this procedure for? It's to adopt rules. That seems very quasi-rulemaking as opposed to a trial. And you're emphasizing actually what happened, right? I mean, there was evidence. I'm wondering if you can tell me why should we pick the actually what happened? How did the proceeding go forth over what kind of the umbrella object of the whole proceeding was? How do we pick which one we should go with?
Because under Rule 54, there's essentially a presumption of awarding costs unless there's a specific statute or rule that states you cannot do so. In this case, there's no specific statute or rule. Had the General Assembly wished to follow what we can call the APA process, what you're discussing, they would not have enacted 501, and by default, the state engineer would be under the APA. Instead, they created the 501 process. This court noted that the opportunity for people to protest then is during that proceeding in Fiji. However, shortly after that, this court then ruled in Port Morgan that the 69 Act, of which Section 501 is part, is subject to costs under 54. And so for the broad picture, we're simply applying what the law says now. The broader picture is, as the court noted, more of a policy consideration for the General Assembly. All we can do is apply what we have now in front of us.
What do you do with that part of the broader picture that allows anyone to participate in these proceedings?
Well, in this case, it's up to the discretion of the water court. As I noted, the Bureau of Land Management and the Water Conservancy District participated, but probably wouldn't, you know, we did not ask for costs against them because it would probably not have been appropriate. There may be other instances where, you know, determining who the prevailing party is more difficult. What if someone asks for a few things, wins on a few, loses on a few? It's within the discretion of the district court to determine who the prevailing party is, when costs are appropriate, and what level of costs are appropriate. And so here, all we're asking this court to do is find that the water court acted within its discretion in this particular case.
Could I ask one question?
Sure.
I keep talking about Fort Morgan. Fort Morgan was pretty clearly a different type of situation. And given the rationale in Fort Morgan, which drew the distinction between the referee and the water court and moving to water court and therefore the civil rules applying, do you think Fort Morgan should have any persuasive effect on us with regard to this kind of proceeding? I mean, in effect, it sounds a little like the argument is, well, you said whenever it's in the water court, and that ends the matter. The rules, the civil rules then apply. And
it's whenever it is in front of the water court indicia of civil litigation, which is that affirmative presentation of evidence actually going to trial, and that draws a distinction between the water referee process, which is very informal, geared more towards a simple settlement, and actual trial. And so this court made that distinction. With the indicia of civil litigation, there is a potential for costs within the discretion of the water court. And we'll give the rest of my time to Mr. Roberts. Thank you.
Chief Justice Malarkey, and may it please the court, I'm David Robbins. Mr. Ampey has previously identified the other attorneys in the room and the parties they represent. I want to start off by dealing again with the appellant's principal argument, which we must address today, which is whether, as a matter of public policy, costs should be awarded to the parties that prevailed on all of the issues in a hotly contested trial over challenges to rules promulgated by the state engineer under 3792.501. I want to be clear, the legislature has remained silent on this issue, and there are no cases or case directly on point. For me to argue that the court should adopt a uniform rule that mandated the award of costs to the state and its supporters every time a challenge to a rule promulgated by the state engineer was denied would be wrong. Similarly, however, to deprive a trial court of the discretion to do so in an appropriate case would also be wrong. Now, I want to very quickly address Justice Hobbs' question earlier concerning costs to the state engineer. And because I want the record to be clear, in Franco versus Golden, a case from 2005, you addressed that specific issue. The water court there had awarded costs to the city of Golden against the state, and the court said no, that could not occur. So I just wanted you to have that.
So the state engineer doesn't have to pay costs in any of these rulemaking proceedings?
That's under in any proceeding, as I understand.
In any proceeding.
Well,
would you then address the public policy involved with the legislature then allowing against those who come in, citizens who come in, citizen groups, any group, any person, in a rulemaking that then would have costs assessed against them? Could the legislature, in a situation where there's ambiguity, and we're trying to find out what the legislative intent is, could have considered that kind of a unilateral situation in a rulemaking context?
The legislature could have, Justice Hobbs, I believe, but I don't believe it has. I don't think the legislature either has suggested that costs are appropriate or costs are not appropriate. We are in an area that has not been addressed, and it is the ambiguity that Justice Ide and yourself and others have questioned, which is how are we going to fit all of this together? Because the legislature has clearly said these rules are going to be tried in a de novo proceeding before the water court. As Justice Rice raised, well, let's look at the PUC. Let's talk about this question of how were the rules formulated. Unfortunately, the legislature hasn't given us much guidance. And in fact, I think this case is going to cause you all to provide that guidance. But the point I want to make here is this was not really a trial about rules. This was a trial about a groundwater model. It did not require 26 days of trial, six attorneys from three firms on the appellant side, the attorney general, and four attorneys from three firms on the other side to sort out the constitutional legal issues of whether the rules were appropriate. What we fought about was a groundwater model with days of expert testimony. That was the case that you ultimately decided in Simpson versus Cotton Creek Circles. That was the case that this water judge sat and watched for 26 days. That is the case that is before us today. It is not really, when all is said and done, sort of the ultimate question of, in all cases, are any citizens who step in and say, we want to protest the rules for this or that reason going to be subject to costs? I argue to you that that is an issue the water judge ought to decide. If a party comes in absolutely well armored with good engineers, good attorneys, and argues for 6 weeks about the underlying factual predicate, which the state has spent 5 years and millions of dollars developing, and the supporters in interest have spent incredible resources trying to develop in a very public process with the data sets and with the model itself on the web publicly available, is that sort of a case one in which the discretion of a trial judge ought to permit the awarding of costs? That's what this case is really about. It's not really about, do we have to make an absolute rule that says every single time the state succeeds, costs are appropriate?
Mr. Robbins, you seem to be arguing for trial court discretion to impose costs in this particular type of proceeding, which is, however, guided in a manner different from how the trial court is guided in determining when and to award costs or not to award costs in ordinary litigation. So to the extent that that's true, can you tell me something about whether you think this court, if we accept your argument, should set forth some parameters of that discretion, and if so, what those should be?
Justice Martinez, it's certainly appropriate were you to decide that parameters ought to be applied. My view of the parameters would be that simply filing a protest to rules of the state engineer does not, should not, and could not automatically result in cost to anyone. There ought to be and should be the informal process leading up to the final resolution that occurs similar to the referee process. I wanted to get to Justice Coates' remarks, and I'm going to do that in response to your question. In the Fort Morgan case, this court basically carefully delineated the difference between the informal process between water users, which should be equally applicable to the informal process of working with a state engineer once rules have been suggested and published, to resolve any differences. Thereafter, if a party decides that it is going to attack the technical fundamental underpinnings, at that point in time, we've got real going litigation and costs would be appropriate. I want to be clear, I'm not arguing to you that costs are appropriate in each case in these rule proceedings because of the very public policy reasons you all have raised in your questioning. What I'm asking you to do is recognize that in this case, for the first, almost the first time, there is, no, it's not the first time. There have been several that the state has lost back in the 70s that were long hammer and tong lawsuits involving the technical underpinning of the rules. This was a trial. This was a fight about a model. And the model was developed to get at the conundrum of the water resources of the San Luis Valley. How are my clients, how are my co-counsel's clients, how is the state going to bring some resolution to the issue of groundwater surface water interaction and the management of the aquifer? The trial judge recognized that in his extensive ruling, which you have sustained in Simpson versus Cotton Creek Circles. And I want to make it clear that if in fact the objectors had succeeded on some or all of their contentions, I'm not sure that in that instance costs would be appropriate. Okay? Even though there was a prevailing party argument. Because in that instance, you know, that it's an open question. They were just raising questions about the rules. But here, not one single argument that was made by the appellants in this case was successful. The state and the supporting objectors were successful at each point.
Well, but, you know, take it for all it is, and what you said is accurately, but the model was, as shown by Justice Rice's opinion, drives the administration of the rules, which is all part of this decision support system, the basin-wide modeling, the study of the aquifers, the interaction with the surface stream. All of that was a hugely public, legislative-driven process that ultimately goes to what this court in Fellhauer asked for, which was a rational rulemaking to integrate the groundwater and surface water resource. Now, all the indicia of what you said is that in this pioneering litigation, which it is, that it's a public process. The state is funded by taxpayer money. The Rio Grande Conservation District is funded by taxpayer money, right? It appears that there's a selective application possibly to private parties of the necessity to bear costs when the public entities don't have to and are funded by the public for a public resource. Isn't that the conundrum of the argument? It seems unfair. It seems inequitable to prevent members of the public from coming in, trying to penetrate whether the model is correct, accurate, etc., as it's going to drive a lot of water resource decisions, including their possible future permits for their members. All of that's true, right?
That is a conundrum. The fact is, however, that that model was developed in a very public process, and these appellants did not participate in that process. To the best of my knowledge, and I want to be clear, it is strictly to the best of my knowledge, they made no effort to do so. Now, I want to address just one thing, and that has to do with whether or not the supporters were properly in the litigation. I read 3792-304 differently than the appellants. 501 refers us to 304 to determine how protests are going to be filed, and 304-2 makes it very clear that protests can either be as objections to the ruling of a referee or in support thereof. And in my view, the statute makes it clear that parties may either come in under 304 and object or protest the ruling of the referee or a rule, given the 501 reference, or they may file a statement in support of the referee's ruling or the rule. So I don't believe that there is any question about that as far as the law is concerned. Now, the other point I want to make, and I only have a few minutes, is that the supporters in this case, in effect, if you agree with my argument on 304-2, properly intervened in this case and were proper parties in support of the rules, and as such, if you agree with my interpretation of 304-2, are just as entitled to costs if costs are to be awarded as the state. And I want to make it clear that the principal supporter of the main point that was at issue, the Rio Grande Decision Support System groundwater model, the principal witness who testified in support of that model, explained the model to the court, and whose testimony was broadly relied on by the court, was Dr. Willem Schroeder, who was the Rio Grande Water Conservation District's expert, not the state's. I want to leave with you the rationale from Fort Morgan. This court went over very carefully this odd hybrid that we have in the water court system that is in some ways different than litigation. And that applies, I believe, in this instance. And that is that you have an informal process that precedes active litigation. And the costs associated with an informal process, that interchange between water users, or by analogy, I believe, water users and the state engineer, goes on, and costs are not appropriate. But once active litigation commences, with all of the indices of normal civil litigation, then 54D does apply. This should be a discretionary issue for the water judge. They're the ones who sit there and look at what's going on in the courtroom. They're the ones who understand whether or not the arguments being made are really arguments that are causing litigation, or if they're just, you know, arguments being made because you don't like the rules. And those judges ought to have the discretion to decide whether or not to apply costs against a party that loses on every single issue, that does not sustain any one of its complaints. The appellants have not shown how the trial judge abused his discretion. He has written 220-some pages of opinion, single-spaced, on all of these issues. And in my view, and I urge you to accept his discretion and accept his decision in this regard. To the extent, as Justice Martinez proposes, you wish to place some constraints on that for guidance of future water judges, I think that's appropriate. There are going to be 501 rules. There have been many promulgated in the past. There will be many in the future. That doesn't mean that costs are always.
Mr. Robbins, were there any of these other rulemaking cases going back to the early 70s that involved the award of costs against other parties?
Justice Hobbs, to the best of my knowledge, and I have been involved in more of them than I care to think about, the answer is no. Many of the early cases, the state was unsuccessful, and the objectors were successful in contested trials. There have been a number, 3 or 4 rulemakings in which objectors came in, negotiated with a state engineer on their concerns, obtained slight modifications to the rules went in further without serious litigation as this was. So this is the first time I'm aware of that costs were specifically awarded in a rulemaking proceeding under 501. I thank the court for your courtesy and your time.
Your Honors, we do not have to show that there was an abuse of discretion with respect to the water court's determination, because this is a legal question that is subject to de novo review by this court concerning whether an award of costs is appropriate in this statutory context. I think the colloquy with Mr. Ampey made clear that there, Justice Rice, there is no formal process for participating in the development of the rules. And while it may be that the water bar of the San Luis Valley was informally involved, that leaves out a whole bunch of people, of Colorado citizens, who might have had an interest in participating in the development of the rules prior to their filing in the water court. Mr. Robbins talked about discretion. Discretion, discretion, discretion. I do not mean to denigrate Judge Keenhold's efforts in this regard, because given his incorrect view of the statutes, he tried very hard to come up with what he thought was a fair resolution regarding the costs. But the fact is that he still awarded $310,000 against the Colorado Association of Home Builders, Cotton Creek Circles, and the San Luis Valley Water Company. That amount of costs is still going to chill participation in water-making proceedings. And the assurance that discretion will be exercised will not be enough to offset that chilling effect. Finally, Your Honors, both Mr. Robbins and Mr. Ampey's remarks seem to set up a situation in which the court ought to look at the degree of participation. And you have, in this case, Cotton Creek Circles on the one hand who participated fully and put on experts, and on the other you have the BLM that just monitored. That sets up, it seems to me, a rule that says if you just go along and watch the proceedings, we will not award costs against you. If you really put up a fight, we're going to hammer you with costs. It seems to me, Your Honors, that is bad public policy. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank all the counsel for arguments. The case will stay.